Okay, here we are for episode 119 of Powers of Principalities. Joe, you're back from Europe, Spain, I believe. How are you doing?
I'm jet-lagged, but it's so good to be back and, you know, speaking with you. I was telling you before the show that it's such a pleasure to talk to you, Tim, because, like, literally you're one of the only sane people that I know. You know, the people in Europe, God bless them, are, you know, they're just living in kind of this matrix of confusion about what history and reality are. And so it's disconcerting because it's hard to have a regular conversation with someone. You can't really, you know, find a point of connection to make it natural. And of course, the fact that I can, you know, barely speak Spanish and French doesn't help anything, you know, makes a very, very confusing situation. But anyway, good to be back. And we were going to talk about good old Henry Luce. I mean, you know, Time Life guy, Skull and Bones guy. So what do you know about him, Tim? What do you want to start out with?
Well, Henry Luce, of course, this is pulled from various sources, Wikipedia, I guess the Time Life website, these things. So Henry Robinson Luce was born April 3rd, 1898, and he passed away February 28th, 1967. He was an American magazine magnate who was called the most influential private citizen in the America of his day. He launched and closely supervised several magazines. These magazines are very important in, I guess, creating American journalism, transforming journalism, and of course, the reading habits and also the thoughts of millions of Americans. Time magazine, of course, was the anchor or sort of the flagship publication. Time summarized and interpreted the week's news. Of course, there's Life magazine, I think, which began publishing in 1935. Life was, of course, was a picture magazine of politics, culture, and society. Featured short articles. This dominated American visual perceptions in the era before television. Then, of course, then there was Fortune magazine. I think that began publishing in 1930, ironically. It reported on national and international business. And, of course, then there's Sports Illustrated, which explored the world of sports. I think that began in the 1950s. He also had several radio projects and newsreels that he produced. He created the first multimedia corporation. He envisaged a United States would achieve world hegemony, and in 1941 he declared the 20th century would be the American century. He was born in China to missionaries, Elizabeth Root Luce and Henry Winters Luce. They were Presbyterian missionaries. He received education in various Chinese English boarding schools, including China Inland Mission Shifu School. At 15, he was sent to the United States to attend the Hotchkiss School in Connecticut, where he edited the Hotchkiss Literary Monthly. There, he first met Britton Hayden, who would become a lifelong partner. At the time, Hayden served as editor-in-chief of the school newspaper, and Luce worked as an assistant managing editor. Both went on to Yale College, where Hayden served as chairman, and Luce as managing editor of the Yale Daily News. Luce was also a member of Alpha Delta Phi and Skull and Bones. After being voted most brilliant of his class and graduated in 1920, he parted ways with Hayden to embark for a year on historical studies at Oxford University, followed by a stint as a cub reporter for the Chicago Daily News. In December 1921, he rejoined Hayden to work as at the Baltimore News. Had several discussions about starting their own newspaper, and later that year, in 1922, they partnered with Robert Livingston and Johnson, another Yale classmate, to form Time Life Incorporated. They raised $86,000 of a $100,000 goal, and they published the first issue of Time on March 3rd, 1923. Luce served as business manager while Hayden was editor-in-chief. By the mid-1960s, Time Inc. was the largest and most prestigious magazine published in the world. Dwight MacDonald, a Fortune staffer during the 1930s, referred to him as El Luce, a play on the Italian dictator Mussolini, who was called El Duce. I think it was, in 1929, he parted ways with Hayden. Hayden got sick, I think, and died. And, Time Magazine. Yeah, Time, who remained the editor-in-chief of all his publications until 1964, maintained a position as influential member of the Republican Party. An instrumental figure behind the so-called China Lobby, he played a large role in steering the American foreign policy and popular sentiment in favor of the Kuomintang leader, Chiang Kai-shek, and his wife, Sun Mei-ling, and their war against the Japanese. The Changs appeared on the cover of Time magazine 11 times between 1927 and 1955. It is reported that Luce, during the 1960s, tried LSD and reported that he had talked to God under its influence. He also had eyes on becoming the Secretary of State. He never did, of course, but he did was influential in having Dwight D. Eisenhower elected president in 1952. Luce penned a famous article in Life magazine in 1941 called The American Century, which defined the role of the American foreign policy for the remainder of the 20th century and perhaps beyond. The term was coined, of course, by Henry Luce to describe what he thought the role of the United States would be and should be during the 20th century. Luce, of course, the son of a missionary, in February 17, 1941, wrote it as an editorial in Life magazine. He wrote, throughout the 17th, 18th century and the 19th century, this continent teemed with manifold projects and magnificent purposes. Above them all and weaving them all together into what the most exciting flag of all the world and in all of history was the triumphal purpose of freedom. It is in the spirit that all of us are called, each to his own measure of capacity, and each in his widest horizon of his vision to create the first great American century. Democracy and other American ideals would do their mysterious work of lifting the life of mankind from the level of beasts to what the psalmist called little lower than angels. Only under the American century can the world come to life in any nobility of health and vigor. According to David Harvey, Luce believed that the power conferred was global and universal rather than territorially specific. So Luce preferred to talk of an American century rather than an empire. In the same article, he called upon the United States to exert upon the world the full impact of our influence for such purposes as we see fit, by such means as we see fit. He was honored by the United States Postal Service with a 32 Great American Series postage stamp. Luce was inducted into the Junior Achievement U.S. Business Hall of Fame in 1977. Of course, he was married twice, and he divorced his first wife in 1934 to marry Ann Clara Brokaw. Of course, she became famous as Clara Booth Luce. And okay, I think she has ties back to the Booth family.
She does, yeah.
This is all very interesting. Chris, she became an ambassador, I think, senator or congresswoman. She was very influential in Republican conservative politics. I mentioned he did pass away in 1967. Of course, that's the life of a brief look at the life and times of Henry Luce. We can talk a lot about his ties to Skull and Bones, what he came, his pedigree. Of course, his publishing empire, which played a key factor in the American century, in the formation or the maturation of the American empire and the interest that lay behind it. So what do you have to say about Mr. Luce?
Gee whiz. Well, you know, he was a very evil individual, and you can't really see how bad a person he was just by sort of looking at him. You have to look at him as part of the structure of information and media that Americans experienced during his lifetime. Because that really, you know, is the problem. It's the key problem, Tim. You know, you when you go to another culture and you see the same forces in operation that are, you know, in play here in the United States, the kind of, you know, this weird Judaic Masonic control, and there just doesn't exist a kind of clarity as to how to get out of the system, how to rebel against it, you know, and Luce was one of the big problems. I mean, you had Luce come from Skull and Bones, which I think is very clear is just an annex of Freemasonry, right? I mean, you had some actual testimony about that of people who broke into the vault, this building that the organization exists in Yale, and they came back talking about Hiram Abiff and all these aspects of Freemasonry that they uncovered, and supposedly it's quite legitimate. I've never seen any contradiction of it, even though there wasn't a lot of hard evidence we've brought out of this. I just think that that this is the case, that it's just that the Freemason Project would have different names. They don't always have to have it as Freemason Lodge. This is basically just something that they can use as a cover, a blind to hide behind. And so you had Skull and Bones, from which all the stuff which becomes Time Life comes from. If you look at the funding for Time Life and the people that he worked with in it, you can see they're all just part of these secret society. And so when you have the narratives that Luce came up with that then becomes history, you have to wonder, well, are they just propaganda? Because in fact, that's really what Time Life was, wasn't it? It was just a way to change journalism so that they could keep the English-speaking world believing in a certain kind of history, which leads to their destruction because they don't have clarity about how to rebel against it. If you don't really know, what the problems are, and the reason that this is so in my mind is because when I was in Barcelona. I was there September 11th, which is National Independence Day, and people were celebrating basically the attempt to secede from the EU, which, I strongly support, but they are just being led by the wrong groups, and they have the wrong history. They have this idea that the Spanish Civil War, that Barcelona was so key in the warfare that went on during it, that this was this purely heroic event. But if you look at the leadership of the rebellion, it's all Masonic, right? And yet none of this is then reported. None of this becomes history. Time Life sets up this kind of dialectic of the freedom fighting anarchists, versus, the fascists. Actually, in fact, this is one thing that really Luce can't be accused of. I'm misspeaking here, because Luce was really more, promoting the other side of the dialectic. But the problem is, Tim, is that no one is mentioning to the people that both sides of the struggle are controlled by the same group. And so this is why I say, life that Luce really needs to be seen. I mean, when you look at like Time Life and you look at like, well, they create these basic, I would call them false dialectics for people to look at history through. You have to say, well, surely there's another group that's going to give better information to the American people, for example. But when you look at Luce in context, when you look at him as like, say, alongside William Paley, right, the head of CBS, you can see that, Paley comes from, he ran, what was it, the or was a member of the Psychological Warfare Board for the OSS, right? Well, you can see the problem is that the basically, what I would call the secret society controls both sides of the, of the way that the world is looked at in the information they put out. And then I would just, just to conclude this a little bit, I would point out that this was really clear with the creation of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, that which Luce was part of with Alan Dulles and McCloy. That basically they were really focused on having a very technologic media. The CFF was basically kind of on the side of more traditional sort of structures of political repression, like fascism. You know, I would say something that they flirted with, but they never criticized themselves. They never brought forward the idea that the media and the history are being controlled by this small group. And so this is why when you look at Luce in the context of all of the people at that time who were creating, you know, the media, you can really see how evil this all is, because it's all, you can see the relationships between them. It's like Luce, he had C.D. Jackson as his editor. And that's another, individual who was involved in the psychological warfare department of during World War II with the OSS. So this is the thing, is that when you look at all of the individuals who are controlling what becomes what we see as history, it's not hard to see that they're all organized against us. And they're all organized basically through these secret societies, through the military intelligence apparatus, through the banking system, all of these different points of power. They seem as though there might be some distinction between them, but there really isn't. They're actually all just this little secret society that's just there to give us the history that will keep us enslaved.
Yeah, this type of partnership between, I guess, media and, I guess, corporate America and the government predates Henry Luce. Good example, an early example would be the run-up to the Spanish-American War in 1898 with Pulitzer and Hearst, both beating the war drums, ultimately doing the bidding, for National City Bank, the sugar interests that envied, the decaying Spanish Empire in the Caribbean and also in the Pacific Ocean. This is when the United States was looking to expand into Asia, the China lobby, the China markets to take advantage of that. But you also have a run up in the First World War that many of the business interests, the Morgan business interests, the so-called Powder Trust, the Merchants of Death, if you will. It also had controlled significant portions of not all the meaningful media at the time, the newspapers. At the time, Oscar Galloway, the senator, I think in 1916 or 17, gave a speech in the Senate about such a conspiracy, if you will, to control the media. And they would buy out a dozen or so major newspapers that controlled the news feed, and that would control the perception of the day. So this was well established, before Henry Luce came into his own. From what I understand, Henry Luce himself, he was, of course, commissioned as an officer, lieutenant, during the First World War, when America had entered into the war in 1917. And in 1918, I guess he was a little discouraged by what he saw as the lack of understanding or education of many of the conscripts going into the American Army at the time, not knowing anything about the world. They didn't know about the Lusitania, of course, what he thought. What the Lusitania was about, or what he thought, what they should know about the Lusitania and these things, international affairs, why farm boys should be well versed in international affairs, at least seen through the lens of Henry Luce and Skull and Bones, I suppose. And so this inspired him and Hayden supposedly to start Time Magazine. And Time Magazine, the way it was published, they were changing journalism by the way they would use words, tell stories. Instead of packing information in the first few paragraphs, they'd spin a narrative, make it interesting. And this was done to sort of lead the reader on, make him feel informed, at the same time he's being carried in a certain direction, given a narrative. And this was an example of the media being controlled. Of course, we can see that as the Time Left Empire expands in the depths of the Great Depression, mind you, so that he's got funding. Life Magazine, of course, this is the visual aspect of propaganda. And you have Time Magazine, who would sort of play to the vanities of the professional class, the middle class, thing, keeping everyone informed. Then there's Fortune Magazine. This is, of course, the American ideology or religion of mammon, being ultimately money being the god that America truly worships. And then the Sports Illustrated came in fitting in the post-war era with the glorification of sports, which really kicked in the post-war era. It's athletes, sports, women in bikinis. This is Americana, right? This is what Americans should aspire towards. So that's kind of the role Time Life plays. We can talk about, of course, you've talked about the role that Life magazine played in promoting the drug culture. Time, C.D. Jackson, ironically, interestingly, C.D. Jackson played a big role, like at Life magazine, covering up aspects of the Kennedy assassination by purchasing the Zapruder film and sequestering it for more than a decade, only publishing, I think, a decade later, certain frames, I think, that were reversed to misrepresent that event. But C.D. Jackson, old CIA hand, of course. There's an interesting, I have to refer to a video on YouTube by Owen Benjamin he recently made. This was very timely because I caught it. He's reviewing Time magazine, and there's a video. It's called "A Look at Time magazine and the Ancient Art of Fear." And what he does is he highlights his various Time magazine covers throughout the years, and he features one in 1987 called "Where's the Beach? America's Vanishing Coastlines." On the cover, they have a picture of a cliff, but 32 years ago, America's coastlines were vanishing. And then he talks about the various big freeze scares that they've published over the years. So, back in early 70s, they had one with a cartoon of Carol O'Connor, Archie Bunker, freezing. Another big chill scare, again, in, I think in the late 70s. Then there was a big drought scare called the Big Dry. Time magazine also in the 1980s led the AIDS crisis, or AIDS scare. AIDS, the Great Threat. And then there was, a few years later, the Big Chill, how heterosexuals are coping with AIDS. This is the 80s, mind you. And then in 1990, there's Torching the Amazon. And the various Time magazine have various nuclear threats or scares, whether it's nuclear meltdown, or nuclear warfare, or nuclear proliferation. A few years ago, there was the Time went after chickens with the avian flu, saying there was going to be a global pandemic. Then there was Time magazine broached the topic of teen pregnancy, where they had the horrifying picture of a pregnant white girl. Although the face of, of course, illegitimacy, teenage pregnancy was overwhelmingly at the time was black. They pick a white girl. And I guess the cover is, teen pregnancy, children having children. But one thing interesting that Owen does in this video is he takes these various covers and how they shape the culture, creates a crisis. And they next public, a few years later, they do a cover story on the crisis, which Time played a part in creating. What he does is his March 1977 Time magazine, "Fighting the Housewife Blues." Basically, this is a sort of a call to women's liberation, having a career. Women are bored with being just housewives. Apparently, that's not fulfilling enough. They need a job to go out and have a career. So they're leading that charge, creating two-income household, flooding the job market, lowering wages, and in the process, destroying the family. And then, 10 years later, June 1987, they have a cover that says, "Who's Bringing Up Baby? With Mom and Dad at Work, the Big Problem is Finding Quality Daycare." Well, they should have thought about that in 1977 when they were preaching women's liberation, having a career over family. Because obviously, if mom isn't home and both mom and dad are at work, someone's got to watch the kids, right? But they don't take any responsibility for this. Now the crisis is, is day quality daycare. Of course, the solution is government-funded daycare. And then they have, in 2000, they have Early Puberty, Why Girls Are Growing Up Faster. Might because they're living in absentee homes or broken homes, a situation much encouraged by Time magazine. They find, he points out that girls who don't have fathers around tend to develop faster, have early puberty for various reasons. One of the things is it's a form of protection because it's their way to get a mate, to get someone to protect them, lacking a father to protect them. But he points all these things out. Says, this is how Time magazine is shaping the culture. Not to mention the fact that you can point to Time magazine. I found a cover with Sports Illustrated with 1976 Bruce Jenner on the cover. Completely different context 30 years later when he's on the cover dressed as a woman. This is Sports Illustrated. This is how they're forming the culture. Right. So I thought that was interesting. So I recommend people go catch that YouTube video called Owen Benjamin. It's a look at Time magazine and the Ancient Art of Fear on YouTube.
Yeah, that you're absolutely right. I mean, I haven't, but I actually have heard about it. I wanted to mention that I think you know this. My grandmother was on the cover of Time magazine.
Oh, really?
She was indeed. She was a best-selling novelist. Wrote kind of ditzy detective stories, mm-hmm. but she was very, very popular, and her films were made into movies. I think it was 45, and this, of course, has led a number of people to wonder about me, if I'm some kind of genetic product, of the Time Life deception thing. But in my grandmother's case, I think they put her on the cover. Actually, I do think it was probably malevolent. I think that the reason that they chose her was not because of her popularity, it's because she was a woman, and they were actually, even in 45, seeing kind of the promotion of women, you know, as the kind of independent, non-family oriented.
Yeah, literary Rosie the Riveter.
yeah, exactly. And I think that's why they chose her, because if you look at her books, I mean, they're pretty lightweight. There's no real, as far as I can tell, there isn't anything malevolent about them. They're just really kind of clever little detective stories. But then she was very, very popular. She was like the best-selling novelist in the 40s in America. And so they put her on. And so, you know, this was like a big deal in my family, you know, that she was like famous and was on the cover. And so I've always kind of, you know, therefore, have been like kind of interested in Time, even from a little, you know, when I first, you know, was pointed this, when this was first pointed out to me. Her name was, her pen name was Craig Rice. And she took it because it sounded masculine. Her real name was Georgiana Craig, but she wrote under the name Craig Rice because it was just, she was, you know, she was like, in her case, she was just pretty destitute in her early life. And so she was just trying to find a way to sell books, and that pen name seemed to work better. But Time played that up.
Mm-hmm.
They played up the kind of the fact that, you know, she had to, it's harder for a woman, you know, to get ahead. And you could see all of the, when I read the article, I hadn't read it in a long time, but I read it a couple of years ago, and I could see that, yeah, they probably are kind of setting up the sexual revolution by putting her on the on the cover. But the magazine itself, I mean, when, you know, one thing I was interested in is, like, I was looking at, you talk about Fortune magazine, but Luce chooses Russell Davenport to become the first editor-in-chief, right? And Davenport is another Bonesman, but moreover, if you look in his background, his father is the senior partner at J.P. Morgan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you talk about the Morgan kind of, you know, cultural vision. So it's this incestuous little clump that controls all of these different aspects of Luce's media empire and the media empire of the United States in general.
Yes, yeah.
And so then it isn't, you know, from there, you go other places. It's like, you know, for funding, he goes to William Hale Harkness, who's related to the Rockefeller family.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, this all just, these are the details that people need to know so they can be sure that the media is just a corrupt propaganda device. You know, Luce used, I think, Tex Moore, and he was, that was like, he was with Cravo, Swain, and Wood, the firm that actually worked with Brown Brothers to get money to Hitler, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and so it's just this tiny little cluster.
And it was Luce who was a cheerleader for getting America into the war against Hitler.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's the one thing I realize is that this isn't an objective news source in any sense, of the war, in no way is it any way objective, because when he gives that speech in February 1941, he's calling for American intervention into the war, which is, you know, already been going on for a year and a half. This is a critical moment in that war. And so his coverage of the events aren't going to be entirely fair and objective. This was kind of borne out because it was Jeanette Conant in her book, The Irregulars, Roald Dahl and the British Spy Ring in Wartime Washington, how Luce was all part of this effort working with British Security Coordination, the Special Operations Executive, which was William Stevenson, the man named Intrepid, was working at a Rockefeller Center, and this was a foreign intelligence operation working with various Americans to get the country into the war using methods that weren't exactly ethical. They would go after groups, you know, like the American First Committee, coordinating with the government, using propaganda, some say even murder, blackmail, and these things to undermine these organizations. And this was a foreign intelligence group operation, with the cooperation of the Roosevelt administration to get the country into this war. And it turns out that Luce, his wife, Claire Booth Luce, Walter Winchell, Drew Pearson, Walter Lippmann, Dorothy Thompson, Edward Murrow, Eric Severide, these names you all know, right? These are towers of American journalism. Of course, Luce was sort of studied under him, and because Walter Lippmann wrote the book Public Opinion. In that book, Public Opinion, he clearly states that we're living in a democracy, the American, that the people cannot be trusted to make up their own minds. They have to be guided and manipulated. You need psychological warfare. And he, along with, Edward Bernays, would sort of perfect this, turn it into a science in the 20s and 30s, all working within, with corporate America, the government, and these things. But it turns out, that all the suspicions about this organization, about, I think, the Committee for the Defense of Democracy or something like that, was, working with British intelligence at the time. This has been sort of overlooked. But this would play a key factor, of course, in the post-war era, because Luce was such a... Luce kind of fell out of favor with the British because he wanted an American century, not a British century. So you saw, maybe perhaps you see sort of a divide in this, because as the British, overt British control was shunted aside for American dominance at the time. But again, he's working with Alan Dulles, Dean Acheson, and these guys to get the country into the war, and working with British intelligence. So that's how you would see, you have to look at Time Life in that context.
Yeah, and then look at, like C.D. Jackson becoming the editor of Life, or was it Time? But anyway, you look at that connection, and then remember that C.D. Jackson was from the war propaganda world, and that he organized, at least apparently, the first Holocaust, propaganda.
Yeah, I think at Belsen and Buchenwald.
So you can see that they're really, that Luce is, I think, frankly, Luce is obviously just a lifetime actor, and like supposedly his hatred of FDR and his promotion of Benito Mussolini. I mean, what's being sold here, Tim, is the dialectic. Mm-hmm. You see, it's like they're trying to create the impression that, there is a dialectic that you really should care about and fight for. This is all absurd. This is just a way to create more political power and more dead people.
Yeah, in the post-war era, it was he played an important part in the Cold War and CIA's development. Claire Booth Luce was named, I think, ambassador to Italy in the 1950s.
Right,
Dwight D. Eisenhower, and I think it was Drew Pearson who said that. Said that the magazine was always operating on behalf of the CIA, meaning often the magazine would give CIA agents cover in these things. This is common in these things.
This is because the CIA is part of the secret society project to enslave the world. And so there really isn't any distinction. There's no distinction between, in fact, in terms of control and where they're trying to take the world, between the CIA and the group controlling Hitler and the Cliveden set in Britain. I mean, they're all just part of this overarching secret society, and they set up these dialectics, these struggles, so that people are distracted. I mean, they have some vested interest supposedly in the outcome of these things, but they fail to understand that the purpose of these dialectics is just to create more political control and to reduce population. If people understood that, I mean, if they could just sit back, and look at, how both sides of the dialectic are sharing so much of the same individuals and same philosophies, they could understand that that this isn't history unfolding, is you're being taken into a world historical structure that's really artificial, and you're just going to get slaughtered. And that's why it's just so useful. Like when you talk about Luce's his American Century, I mean, this ultimately becomes the project for the new American Century, right? With Crystal's stuff, which then becomes the current endless wars, where the Muslims are being depopulated. These dialectics, you just have to not ever trust them, and always look into the background of the individuals who are leading, these kinds of these sort of historical events into existence. I mean, like I was in Barcelona, and everyone is so, talking about the glorious past of Barcelona's, insurrection against, Spanish domination. But they don't look at the leadership of the rebellion and how it's not all these so-called anarchists and see that really these people are all Masons and Jews. They're not, I mean, Catalonians, I mean, in any real sense of they're not distinct from, their distinct backgrounds. So it's and this is why, of course, when Franco defeated the rebellion, he came into Barcelona and got rid of all the Freemason symbolism. He was actually, it's very interesting, he was one of the first things he did because he knew that the Masons were actually, in back of this. The Catalonians thought that they were in some kind of legitimate rebellion, and in fact, they were because they had some, real gripes against the way Catalonia was being treated, evidently. And they had a kind of a separate ethnic and language identity from the rest of Spain, and they wanted their own form of government, which just seems perfectly sensible. But the problem is they weren't being led by the right group to in order to achieve it. They were just being led by this other group, which whose real purpose was just to slaughter Europeans and to shatter the Catholic culture, because that's really what they were most interested in destroying. Maybe we should do a show on that at some point because I don't want to, go too far away from Luce, but it's just, and then of course that the real history now doesn't get reported. You get, Life magazine talking about the struggle between fascism and anarchism, right? But you don't understand that Franco at that point was really more just traditional Catholic values, and the stuff going on in Catalonia was the anarchists and stuff were all coming. They were all Masons, So how legitimate can that be? But where is the reporting? Where is the real history being given to people?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that because it was Henry Luce, Time magazine, which sort of implemented the say's doctrinal warfare program that was targeting various religions in the post-war, particularly the Catholic Church. And he took one Jesuit priest, John Courtney Murray, under his wing and promoted him, put him on the cover, of course. And John Courtney Murray was a big advocate of Americanism and the so-called American proposition. And this was the idea that somehow the American system of government, separation of church and state, was ideal and the optimal form of government for humanity, as opposed to a confessional state, which was the traditional Catholic view of these things. And they were Americanism itself was a form of liberalism, which had been declared a heresy by Leo XIII in the late 19th century. This is a problem for American Catholics because American Catholics from the get-go had sort of had a problem in its relation to the American state, which is sort of a Freemasonic, and also a largely Protestant creation, But the idea was, the idea of Catholicism, where a Catholic would seek to convert a culture that came upon, wouldn't seek to kind of create a modus vivendi. That's when America is always like, you leave us alone, let us have our life, and we'll be happy. And that's the problem with the American Catholicism itself. But in the post-war era, it was weaponized by the CIA and through Henry Luce, who used John Courtney Murray as an agent to spread this doctrine throughout the Catholic Church of America, and also at Vatican II, which so much of the now it's sort of an accepted belief throughout in the Catholic Church now. The Pope today, condemns confessional states and preaches the virtues of separation, church and state, which is actually contrary to traditional Catholic teaching. But this was a thing that was implemented, or a program that was implemented, it was critical years in Vatican II, and he was sent as an agent. And this is a time when America, Catholic identity itself was under assault because of you know, the creation of the interstate highway system, the creation of suburbia, urban renewal, you know, the attack of the ethnic neighborhoods and this stuff. This is sort of the deracinate the Catholics, the ethnic Catholics, to create the white middle class that the American leadership needed for the so-called American century, for the Cold War. And so this was done, that was a program that was specifically targeting the Catholic Church, because they understood that you don't destroy the Catholic Church, you infiltrate it and you take it over, you know. And that was their strategy in the 50s and 60s, and they seem to have largely have succeeded.
I think the Masons always had it as literally from day one, from the Knights Templar, to take over the political structure of the Catholic Church, because it really was both the theological and secular structure that they were wanting to destroy. Yeah. So the way to do it is to take over. And I mean, the current Pope, in my opinion, is just, you know, a Satanist. I mean, I don't know if like a better word. I don't want to digress too far, but I was in Gaudi's church. It's a Catholic church. I mean, Tim, it's the most Masonic, satanic thing I've ever seen in my life. It looks like the Addams Family house. I mean, there's just weird shapes and forms. It's just it's the most unspiritual thing imaginable, and it's kind of, I mean, and the Pope is like really, you know, the Pope is really wanting to have the thing finished so he can. You know, they think he's gonna honor it as being a cathedral, but the public, because the media is so bad, don't recognize that the thing is 100% Masonic monstrosity. On one of the back of it, you don't see it in the famous pictures of the front of the thing, but in the back of it, there's this huge number puzzle. Did you know that? There's like a big number puzzle. Gaudi's a Mason. The guy who's funding Gaudi is a Mason. All of the Barcelona industrialists, unfortunately, were Masonic. This was what was going to be, you know, leading up to the whole, catastrophe of the Civil War. But so Gaudi put a number puzzle with all of these numbers in a box. And if you add them up sideways, diagonally, left, right, they all add up to 33, right? And then there's other just more obvious Masonic things. But the guide who I had was saying, well, they don't know exactly why Gaudi did this. They think it's because that was the year Jesus was crucified, his age. And I said, well, why would Gaudi need to put that in a number puzzle? I mean, if number puzzles are more associated with Masonic secrecy, are they, than like something as overt and clear-cut as the age of Jesus Christ, why would he need to camouflage it with this thing? You know, why don't you do a little research into Freemasonry and then have another, you know, come up with some other alternative explanations as to why you'd have this perverse number puzzle on the side of what's supposed to be is a Catholic church, you know? But you see, again, it's just the blindness, you know. They don't think about this. Tim, I'm going to go into a huge digression here, which you can please stop me if I go too crazy, because I'm jet lagged like to the hill. But I thought I was, you know, you had mentioned sort of like World War II, and we were talking before the show, and you know, I happened to live in the one place where. The Japanese actually or were able to shell a U.S. soil successfully during World War II, Santa Barbara. They actually attacked us. We attempted to surrender, but we weren't able to. But do you know the background story to that?
A little bit. I know there was some talk about Los Angeles being shelled, which some would say is a fake story.
Yeah. No, this is kind of amusing. I mean, it's kind of a weird digression of someone who's jet lagged. But I got to tell you, because it's a true story, and it's really sort of amusing. So before the war, there was a delegation of Japanese who came to the United States to look at our oil fields. And they were military people, and they came to just an area just outside of Santa Barbara called Goleta, where we have oil, we had oil derricks and refineries at that time, like this would have been in the late 30s. And while touring, one of them slipped and fell into basically an oil pit. And you can imagine, how that looked with his white naval Japanese uniform coming out of this tar pit. I mean, it was covered with black, and the Americans who were there with him all laughed. They thought this was the funniest thing they'd ever seen. And this was really humiliating. And so then years later, this guy happened to be the captain of a submarine that was off the U.S. coast. And so he brought the ship alongside the oil refineries and lobbed a few shells in. And that is a true story. And that was, the basis of the Japanese attack on Santa Barbara. Is that, so you can see that oftentimes, war has, means of causes and things which are outside of these historical structures. But anyway, sorry for the digression, but I thought you'd get a kick out of that.
I didn't know that size. That's funny.
No, that's and that actually, like when they, then you had the Battle of Los Angeles, which was, just mass hysteria.
Yeah. It led to the executive orders, which resulted in the seizure of all the Japanese property in California.
Right? And exactly right. See, this is right. And so,
it's a few tribe members profited mightily from.
Of course. They took everything, that the Japanese had. They saw an opportunity to increase their wealth, and they just did it. It was completely illegal. But because of the hysteria of the L.A. Attack, which was brought about by the Santa Barbara attack.
Mm-hmm.
This is the thing, is that the Santa Barbara attack occurred, and then, we went on high alert here in Southern California. You had guys with, bringing out their Winchesters so they could stay on the beach, and stop the Japanese from invading. But it was all, it was all because of this vengeance for humiliation by this one guy who slept in the mud pit, carpet. So, that's war.
Well, I mean, you mentioned the media, because again, go back to Henry Luce and his media empire, is that he's controlling, it's perception management. He's controlling people's thoughts and perceptions through media control. And that's largely how the effort at Vatican II was carried out, because why the John Courtney Murray wasn't really able to change the official documents of Vatican II. It was through Time Life, through Time Magazine, that the interpretation of Vatican II was handled. And that was done, again, through Henry Luce's Time Magazine. And that's how most people came to understood what Vatican II meant. And that had a profound effect on the Catholic Church, in the late 60s and 70s. And that was, again, the importance of media power.
And look at how they have contradictory themes. I mean, as an example, we covered Woodstock,
mm-hmm.
right, which they glorified. I mean, Time Life just glorified Woodstock. They had a special edition. In addition to the original photographic coverage, which was, 100% glorious, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, freedom. This is,
then they put Madonna on the cover. Is this be a news magazine?
Yeah, right. But remember, this is coming from the same group that comes up with the American Century concept.
Yeah.
So it's just whatever version of, cultural domination.
I mean, Madonna is just a later stage assault on Catholic culture in America.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but then like with Claire Booth Luce, she made that famous quote, which was picked up. I'm not sure where it was published, though, but it's a true quote. I mean, she said, she's talking about LSD, and she says, I'm worried that people will start using it because you don't want people to do too much of a good thing.
yeah.
I mean, it's just obvious mind control. I mean, she's basic. They were part of they knew that drugs were a great thing to give to the, mind-altering drugs were a great thing to give the public because it's just made them easier to control.
Mm-hmm.
So when that is your purpose, when that's your goal, then you just set up whatever, kind of description of history you want. So this is our problem, Tim, is that it was transparent in Barcelona, and it's perfectly clear when we go through the Time Life empire that Luce set up, is that it's just nonsense. You know, it's not nonsense. It is inaccurate history that is being shaped for propaganda, for mind control. And it just goes on all the time. And then when you look at, you know, I was looking, you know, as to like, well, where was, you know, when for example, like when Luce is like glorifying Woodstock, just take that as an example. Well, where was the mainstream during this to like give another explanation? You know, like I think it was fairly easy in our show to show the relationship between MK Ultra, the acid tests, and Woodstock, right?
Yeah, which ties back to Life magazine, as you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the fact that that they brought in the Merry Pranksters. I mean, how hard is that to link back to, you know, to things which they should have, and of course were well aware of, being part of a government operation. Why would this be not something that would be brought up? You go, okay, well, Luce, you know, he's skull and bones. Where's the rest of the American press? But then when you go through the American press, you can see the problem. You know, you have in Washington Post, I mean, you know, you had Catherine Meyer Graham, right? I mean, she's not going to come forward and criticize this stuff. It's just you have a group in control of the media that is, they're organized into creating a fake world, fake dialectics, you know, fake facts. You can imagine, like, when you're jet lagged, and I'd been on a plane for like God only knows, you know, it's a nightmare getting back to Santa Barbara, and I turn on the TV to catch up with the local news. I've been out of touch, and the first thing I see is this Greta Thunberg creature. You know, you've been following this little girl who's like, against the environmental destruction.
Yeah, then she's sparring with the president.
Yeah, you know, and the thing is, you know, God bless this little child. I mean, obviously, you know, someone who has like solar panels on his house and drives an electric car, and very much an, you know, advocate of trying to not let the environment become more toxic. And I really am concerned about the toxicity, right? I think it's organized and it's damaging, you know, our brain power and stuff. But when I was listening to her and seeing some of the clips about this young girl, I mean, you know, she has Asperger's, right?
I heard she's...
They were promoting it as a superpower, and they were actually talking about neural diversity and how it's the fact that her brain works in a damaged way, basically, is that this is like a superpower. You see what I mean? It's like you can see how the Brave New World with the, you know, the intellectually stratified levels is being onset, and so that everything about this person is artificial, but she's being manipulated into a propaganda role, and the media is obviously is complicit. They have to be involved in this thing because no one is challenged. I mean, when someone who is just introduced into culture so overnight, right? She's like Gloria Steinem. I mean, she just shows up. I'd never even heard of her, and all of a sudden she's on every single talk show. You have to wonder if this is, you know, an introduction of a psychological structure. And in this case, man, I think it's just obvious that, climate change, so that we need a world dictatorship and the praise of neural diversities, because we are going to be really neurally diverse if we take enough fluoride.
Yeah, yeah. It's the hyper-normalization, Adam Curtis calls it, where these things just become accepted. It's interesting here because what we're talking about here is We heard talk about in the 20th century, the Communist International.
Yeah.
And what we see with figures like Luce, he's really working for, doing the bidding for what we call the Capitalist International. And the idea of capitalism is you got to, I mean, in order to spread markets and spread hegemony, control, these things, you have to destroy impediments to markets and marketing and selling things. And that usually means tradition, custom, are impediments to these things. And so you have to, a good example, that would be destroying Catholic identity, because there's a lot of impediments there, not just the theology and philosophy to Americanism, which is like pure materialism and, carnal, satisfying your carnal desires, and that's what the market provides. And that's what magazines, you know, like Time and Fortune and Life and Sports Illustrated fulfill. It changes, you know, your outlook, your expectations in life. That's why you'll on the cover, you know, Time magazine, you have Marilyn Monroe and there, or Jackie Robinson or Mickey Mantle for time to time. Then a serious political issue, or then another musician perhaps, but. You have to have these experts. You mean, you have to have these people who can market, who can manipulate. And this is what people like Walter Lippmann and Edward Bernays and Henry Luce, that's their job in all this stuff. And it's there to manipulate you. And you know, we can look at something like Time. When you look at the history of Time Life Incorporated, and Time Magazine and Life Magazine, and the influence that these magazines had on American culture for several decades, you wonder why they ever bothered to, like, formalize this control with Mockingbird. I guess they needed to more direct control in these things, where Operation Mockingbird is an example of this, you know, where, you know, as many as 400 of the nation's top journalists were on the payroll of the CIA. And of course, all the pretext for this is the Cold War. And so this is their excuse for these things. But regardless, whether justified or not, the thing is, the media is not independent, and it's not diverse, it's all controlled, and that's how you get such consensus, I guess you could say, in the coverage we see. Now it's gotten a lot worse, because the consolidation in the media has gotten a lot worse. As I think five or six corporations control 90-95% of the news we get, and now for the most part, establishment media, these things are completely, I think most people know, they're just complete tools of the oligarchs. And we have, you know, alternative news. You know, in the past, we just had newsletters and these things. But now, you know, the past 20 years, we've had the internet. And now that seems to be gradually shut down, at least attempting to corral it and control it. You know, deplatforming in these things. For about 10 years, maybe 15 years, these media tycoons or giants, I think tycoon itself was a word that Time magazine, Henry Luce coined, to describe big wigs.
Yeah.
Their monopoly was shattered, and it is being challenged to this day comparatively very small group of people. But it's interesting to say how they can't even tolerate or withstand the slightest bit of scrutiny or debate in these things. They have to shut everything down.
Yeah, no, they can't. I mean, the whole thing falls apart if any kind of sunlight is put on their organization. It can't stand any sunlight at all. I mean, if you start looking at the relationships between like military intelligence, secret societies, the Jewish banking families, and you look at these groups as how they are affecting and controlling media. I mean, why would anyone believe anything that comes out of it? When you talk about Mockingbird, I think that was really, I mean, obviously they had control over all of the newspapers already. I think Mockingbird was just put into effect to get rid of a lot of the people who are on the street, you know, to replace them with basically more controlled agents. I think there was too much freedom of investigative journalism that was going on, and so they end up with something like Mockingbird just as a funding device to make sure they could replace as many of the reporters and journalists that were basically not under direct control, because they already had control financial control over all the media anyway at this point. They were just trying to get rid of everyone who was, not on the farm, so to speak, And so, anyway, you talk about how small the alt media is. Yeah, we're small, but we have one little thing, which is the truth. And the most, I mean, to me, it was just, gosh, it was so clear when I was like wandering around Barcelona, talking to people and trying to get, I was interested in their understanding of the current struggle and how it related to the past. And I wanted to know what people thought in Catalonia about the original rebellion, the one in the 30s. And it was just 100% clear that they didn't have a clue. They really didn't. I mean, no one had really done a lot of research into the Masonic influence of the anarchist movement, of the the group that rebelled against Franco's Spain in the 30s. They hate Franco, and because of that, I mean, there's almost no Catholicism left. And I didn't look at the rest of Spain, but certainly in Catalonia. They were very
successful. I mean, that's funny how the Catholic Church itself, how Franco was sort of deserted or left to hang out to dry by the Catholic Church in the 1960s, because the Catholic Church embraced liberalism and sort of the constitutional model of liberalism, something like the United States has, separation of church and state, where the Catholic Church, Franco had come out for the confessional state and these things in the 1950s and 60s. It was an authoritarian government. But if you look at what happened to Spain after Franco's death in 1975, the church deserted him and his regime, and 3 years later they adopted a liberal constitution, and look what has happened to Spain since then.
Well, yeah, I mean, so when you have these kind of fulcrum points, where culture is changing, boy, the citizen would be really well advised to try to get to an understanding of the background of the people who are driving the thing.
What, in your sense, why do they hate Franco?
Well, they're just the propaganda. I mean,
he's a dictator, that type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, a dictator, and basically he was immoral. I mean, the things that they were talking about Franco, the stories that were kind of in circulation. Basically, he was just a very immoral character, and he was a fascist and a dictator, and there were no stories. And of course, this is Catalonia, where you can kind of understand just from a cultural perspective. But nevertheless, there were nothing about the raping of nuns, of priests. I mean, the behavior of the anarchists. And I mean, look at the, I don't know if you ever read Emma Goldman, she was brought in by the Masons to try to organize the women. I mean, her writings are about as bloodthirsty as anything you've ever seen in your life, I mean, Franco would have to be completely deranged to go to the extremes that the anarchists were taking. They really, it's interesting that the anarchists targeted the church. They actually, their leadership, the Masons, understood that as basically what they wanted to destroy. And then when Franco gained control over Catalonia, his response, he went after the Masons.
Mm-hmm.
It was illegal following the Civil War to display any symbolism of Freemasonry in Catalonia. You can see how clearly it was to Franco, who were really leading the rebellion. In fact, even to this day, you'll find little hidden Masonic symbols throughout Catalonia, because you couldn't have overt symbols, So you have these little like a five-legged a starfish with a G kind of like the shaped by a natural thing in the middle. You know what I'm saying? They would have sonic symbols that were just cryptic, which of course the one that was just shocking to me was Gaudi's number puzzle on the church, on the famous Gaudi church, which let me just repeat is the most monstrous satanic thing I've ever seen in my life. They're still building it. I mean, 100 years after something like that, after he started it. And when it's done, it'll have four huge towers that go up, which will have animals on the top of each one that'll look like giant horns. I mean, it's just the people who are, the public is just so naive,
No, I'm
they
just
just.
saying, Franco Ferrara's fault, what he was dealing with, and who he was fighting against, the forces he was fighting against. It's funny that he would get such bad press, yet, the Democratic elected leaders at the time, whether it's Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Harry Truman, or Winston Churchill, how many deaths are they responsible for?
How could Franco be any less moral than Winston Churchill? I mean, total war, right? I mean, he slaughtered hundreds of, well, millions and millions of civilians.
And Franco kept his country out of the slaughter.
And well, not only that, but he was really, I mean, basically, I really wanted to, I didn't have a chance to do enough research in this. I had this one guy I was going to get a chance to talk to, but we couldn't hook up. And anyway, it didn't, so I didn't get the one critical guy I wanted to get data from. I couldn't arrange our schedules didn't link up. But I think that even during the Civil War, Franco knew that the Masons were actually the problem, and that I think he was targeting them. I think that a lot of the so-called atrocities from Franco were actually direct kind of agent assassination attempts to get rid of the Masonic leadership. I can't prove that, but I am interested in this as a concept because I had a couple people tell me that this is flat out the case. So that what Franco is being charged with, this brutality was actually targeted assassination of Masonic leaders because he knew that these were the people who were taking, Spain off a cliff.
So,
So interesting.
okay, Joe, I know you're jet lagged, so I'll let you go.
I just want to apologize to you and everyone for being so brain dead. I'll certainly rally here. This jet lag stuff is kind of bizarre. I mean, don't make any financial decisions after you've been on a long plane ride.
Next time, take a steamboat.
I will. Well, anyway, I'll be back next
Steamer.
week. Tim, it was great just hearing your voice. It's nice after being in on all of the topless beaches. Talk to you. It's like it's a pretty strange thing. We were in Cassis, which is this little town on the other side of Marseille. We're visiting friends, and we went. They're really not. It's like a little tiny place. There's not much to do but go to the beach and swim. Great swimming. There's a lot of interesting little. They call them the calanques. These are like fjord type places, but the beaches are naked. And I mean, if it's like an attractive young woman, you have the all of the problems, involved with that. But there's nothing, that can compares to some like 70-year-old wrinkled guy just propping drawers like 2 feet from you and like changing into a Speedos to go for a swim. I mean, it was pretty shocking. I mean, it's like, what can I say? It's the people who have illusions about the nude beaches in France, they should spend some time in Cassis. They could see a lot of this is not exactly body beautiful material.
No, usually it's not the people you'd want to see.
No, that wasn't happening too much. Oh, anyway. Well, good hearing your voice, Tim. I'll look forward to talking to you next week,
Again, enjoy
okay?
the rest of your weekend. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.